Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast. I am honored that you're here. I thank you for your time. Thanks for listening to this show. It means a lot to me. I hope that you're enjoying getting to hear songs, the stories about songs, and talking with all kinds of different people about the stories behind hopefully some of your favorite songs. I'm hitting on songs that I love and artists that I love, and I hope that you are enjoying them too. Started the podcast about a year and a half ago, so if you are here for the first time, one, please be sure and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. Two, there's a great backlog of some really great episodes. And so today I am really pumped getting to talk with Dave Perner, who's the lead singer of Soul Asylum. Man, I'm telling you, like I was so into, I was a teenager when all these 90s bands came out and just obviously made a huge impact on me. I'm still talking about them. But I'm grateful that I get to do it. You know, who would have ever thought? I bought so many of these Soul Asylum CDs and was rocking out as a dorky kid to Runaway Train and Black Gold. And just they have so many great songs. And I'm thrilled to be able to talk with Dave today. He's talking about his new record that's out now, as well as the next record that he's writing, and it's just totally cool. And so I've been able to talk to a couple 90s bands. If you haven't heard it, I did another interview with Art Alexakis, lead singer from Everclear, and some other bands as well, if you want to go back to other episodes. But man, Soul Asylum, great band. Solid songwriting, great singer. And so Dave talks today about what they've been up to, what the pandemic's been like, and then he indulged me in my questions about, can you tell me about Runaway Train? Let's talk about that. And then you may not know that when Courtney Love first met Kurt Cobain, because you know I love Nirvana, she said, "You look like Dave Perner," which is in reference to Dave, who I'm speaking to today. So we bring that up. And anyway, it's just cool. And so thank you for listening to the show. If you know anybody that likes music, please feel free to pass on the show. I'm trying to get more people to listen because it's fun. It's fun having a community of people who love music and love to talk about music. You can come find me online. I'm specifically active on Instagram. It's at Songs of Note. Come say hey to me there. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter, but or send an email. Another thing is you can send me an email if there's a song you'd like to hear the story behind. The email is thesongsofnote@gmail.com. And without further ado, let's head on over to the interview. This is Dave Perner, lead singer of Soul Asylum. Hey, this is Ryan. I have Dave Perner here on the phone, lead singer of Soul Asylum. Dave, thank you so much for taking time to chat today.
Hello, Ryan. How you doing?
Man, I am good. I'm really pumped to be talking to you today. Thanks for taking my call, and I'm excited to talk to you about some of your songs.
Well, fire when ready, my man.
Let's do it. Well, so my first question is, I saw, you know, you guys had a release last year, Hurry Up and Wait. It looked like it had been 4 years since your previous release. What was that like, getting to the point of putting out an album and then it comes out and we're in a pandemic? What was that like?
It was terrible timing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We had just, we were almost done with a tour that was like, we sort of toured across America to sort of set the record up.
Okay.
So then the record was supposed to come out and then we're supposed to go back out on tour. And, we were in San Diego, I think, and, knock on the hotel room door. Hey, Dave, tour's over. And that was it.
Man.
First time I've ever put out a record and not gone and toured the hell out of it.
You know? Well, and I imagine there was so much probably work in writing those songs and recording them. I'm sure you were pumped up to go perform them.
Yeah, we were playing some of it already. Uh-huh. But I also put a book out.
Which, I saw that.
You know, when I was supposed to go out and
do like a book tour,
whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, I was supposed to do that too. So,
man, crazy year. Well, I wonder if you talk a little bit about Hurry Up and Wait. What were the kind of the things that you were thinking through and processing while you're writing those songs, and any themes behind them that you're into?
Well, I think we were talking about what kind of record we wanted to make, where to record it, and how to record it. And we were in New York, and I talked to a couple guys that wanted to produce the record, and their concept was to get the band in like a building, like a church, you know, like an acoustic, and have us play live and have it be acoustic.
Okay.
So I started thinking about that, and then, I just started writing a lot of songs, with the acoustic guitar for one reason or another. Maybe that was part of it, but, it was something that I kind of was gravitating towards. Just, you know, I'm going to do the acoustic guitar thing. It's always been pretty reliable for me, as far as if I can play the song on the acoustic guitar by myself, then, you know, it should be solid enough to sound great with a band. And that was kind of the inception, and we ended up doing it here in Minneapolis because it just makes too much sense. And it was probably I'm not really sure, but the recording process was, I would say, really smooth for us. I mean, in the past, making a record has been a really agonizing, arduous experience. So we're kind of, you know, the guy that produced John Fields, who produced our last couple records, he moved back to Minneapolis, and he got a studio space in the studio where we recorded Made to Be Broken.
Nice.
You know, some of our first records. So it was very, it felt very full circle to be kind of back on Nicollet Avenue. You know, like all the businesses have changed except for the studio. So it's kind of funny to walk out the front door and see that everything is different, but it's just going home after, you know, not recording in New York or LA or whatever. It makes a lot of sense, and it makes it, you know, all my here now. So, you know, all my notebooks and everything, and you're not living in a hotel room and all that kind of stuff. So it was actually kind of fun.
Well, and there you go.
You know, very much us doing it on our own terms. You know?
That's a good thing. I mean, I feel like that comes across on the record. I really enjoyed it. I mean, it sounds like y'all are having fun. Sorry, I'm saying y'all. I'm a Texas guy here, but I saw you also put out an EP, the Born Free EP, and those are all acoustic songs. Did those kind of come out of that initial thinking about writing the songs from an acoustic angle with the church recording? Was that connected to that at all?
Yeah, and one of the things. I mean, I'm working on a record right now. I'm working on the next record, and it's a little bit different approach. But one of the things that often happens is that I'll get the song close to where it's finished, and then I'll sit down with my guitar player and sort of run through them. Mm-hmm. And, And that I guess that's kind of what you're hearing is on the EP. It's just me and Ryan, and that. So you're kind of hearing the songs the way they were before we added the rhythm section, basically. Okay. And that's kind of all been part of the process for a while now.
Nice. Well, you kind of mentioned it briefly, but you did put out a new book this last year, and it's called Loud Fast Words, which I imagine that's really, what is it, gratifying to have a collective lyrics book? What was it like to look back on all your songs and see all your work in one hand, like looking at all of it? Was that meaningful?
Well, I see what you're saying. It was cool to just finally have it all in a volume where okay, there it is.
Yeah.
Now I don't have to wonder where lyric sheets are or what words to songs are. So there's been a couple instances where I've done, let's play this old song, and I just go, oh yeah, I open up the book and I there's the lyric.
There you go.
It was really reflective in a way that sometimes it was kind of difficult to try to analyze my 20-year-old, my
mindset,
17-year-old songwriting or whatever.
Right.
But it's strange to me that I've been doing this for that long. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I've wondered about that, as far as, even looking at like somebody like the Beatles, like somebody like Paul McCartney, who wrote some of their most famous songs when he was like early 20s. And now he's, so many years later. And I wonder in a different way for you, like, are you able to see the thing that you wrote a long time ago that it still has high value, even though as a songwriter and musician, you've grown so much through the years? Are you still able to say, hey, that thing was really good as somebody expressing themselves as a younger person? Does that question make sense?
Yeah. I don't know what the word is. The word is not value in my brain. The word is kind of, I can see myself learning my trade, if you will.
Okay.
I can see how I was sort of struggling my way through it, and is it charming to me? A little bit, it kind of, I can see the effort, and I can see the age, and I can it will evoke that time. So
yeah.
If I read a lyric from 1981, it does sort of transport me back to that time, because the lyrics are sort of related to what was happening in my life. So there is that part of it where, even when I'm singing some songs today, it can't help but sort of put me in the place where I was when I wrote it, for good or for bad,
That makes sense. Like you said, you guys have been around since the early 80s. I mean, what an incredible career and a gift, I would imagine, to be able to say that you're still doing the thing that you love. What were some of the bands along the way that really influenced you? Like, for some reason, I've always wondered if the Replacements were a big influence on you, but I don't know if that's true.
Well, there was a first wave of kind of punk music that came through Minneapolis, and I was about 15 years old when I first discovered the local music scene in Minneapolis. And these were bands like the Suicide Commandos and the Suburbs and a bunch of bands that really, that's when I realized that music did not just come out of the radio, or it didn't come out of California or or whatever, or some far off place, New York City. I was like, oh God, there's bands, there's punk bands in Minneapolis. I just was too dumb. You know, I was too young to get into bars, so I started following it as much as I could, and they would play like a, they would do shows at the Walker Arts Center, and they would do shows outside. So anytime there was a band playing where it wasn't at a bar, yeah, I was there.
Nice.
By and by, you know, of course, Husker Du and the Replacements were bands that were doing, we're doing pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
So we went out on tour with Husker Du, and we spent a lot of time in the company of Husker Du. They had an office right next to the Twin. Their office and Twin Tones' office was on the same floor of the building where we just recorded our last record.
Really?
And so you had a very tight-knit community with all the local bands. I mean, it was very much, we would play a gig and half the audience would be people in bands.
Nice.
And vice versa. You know, the Replacements and Husker Du had kind of like two different approaches in a very punk rock sort of way. The thing that I took away from it was, if you want to do it, you got to do it yourself. And that was, you know, that was an aesthetic in the day. I don't know if aesthetic is the right word, but the whole DIY thing was not lost on us at all. I mean, the Replacements had Pete Jesperson, who was a manager, and they were the only band in town that had a manager. So, you know, we spent a lot of time opening for both those bands, and I mean, it was a good. Husker Du were very supportive, and you know, I'll always have them to thank for letting us know that if you're going to do it, you got to do it yourself, and you can't turn on anybody else, and you just got to, you know, put your nose to the grindstone, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I had read somewhere that when you guys were really taking off in the early 90s, mid 90s with your singles, that are you and Bruce Springsteen friends? Did y'all get close? Like, I feel like I had read something about he was kind of providing some insight into into your life. Is that true?
My older sister was a big Springsteen fan, and I probably owe a debt to my older sister because I constantly raided her record collection. And
nice.
I think when did I first meet? I think I met Mr. Springsteen at in New York. He came to a show and he came on stage and he did Tracks of My Tears. I guess we spent some time together. I had a really nice long dinner with him and his mother, which was a very special experience. Listened to a bunch of records with him, and he called me because he was thinking about working with Butch Vig.
Oh, okay.
And we talked on the phone for an hour just about making records and stuff. So there was a few different instances where I went and saw him play, and we hung out, or we went to dinner, or we went to my favorite bar in New York together, which was really kind of funny because people were just kind of couldn't understand what was happening. Like, holy shit. And I'm like, hey, man, you know, I'm just hanging out with my buddy.
Yeah,
here,
my buddy Bruce.
Stop bugging us, you know.
That's awesome. Well, I imagine, don't let me put words in your mouth. I imagine looking back at the 90s that, I mean, gosh, y'all are just in the midst of, y'all were a great band at the time in the midst of so many other great bands. Like when I think of music as far as in enjoyable times, for me, it's the late 60s that's a high point, and then it's the 90s that's a high point. What was it like being a band in the 90s where people are just absorbing so much music and so much good music was being created around you? Was it crazy? Was it pressure? Was it too hard to put into a...
Well, it was... I mean, if the band started in 1981,
yeah,
or 19... You know, so when people talk about the 90s, it was like we were well established
right
by then. We'd been around the world in a van, basically. So it was really cool to see the kind of music that we were making become more of a spectacle or more... I would say maybe less underground, which for better or for worse is just kind of what happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the Butthole Surfers and the Meat Puppets and all these bands that I love were starting to get the attention that they deserve and signed to major labels and stuff, yeah, that was pretty exciting because, you know, you can easily wallow away in obscurity, and it's just what it is. It's what we were used to.
Right.
It was fun to see people get their due, you know? It was fun to hear the Butthole Surfers on the
radio. I bet you never thought that would happen. I bet they never thought that would happen. That's cool. Well, I wonder if you would indulge me, and if you're over it, please just say no. But something that we do on the podcast is I love asking people about, you know, some of the songs that are most popular. I know you've been asked this question probably a million times, but would you indulge me and tell me a little bit about what you remember about writing Runaway Train and or anything about specifically writing that song and what that was like, having people accept it on such a mass level?
I wrote it and I was dealing with pretty hardcore depression, and it was a very sort of dark time when I had written the song. It kind of got the ball rolling again, and I started working with an acoustic guitar at that point, which I hadn't done. I mean, I
really
rarely picked up an acoustic guitar. And I you know, it just wasn't part of the punk rock thing. But, you know, once I sort of embraced it, it started to make a lot of sense. We demoed the songs. Like, we demoed 25 songs, I think, in our practice space. And that's what ended up becoming Grave Dancers Union.
Man.
And
great album.
And it's, people reacted to that song in a way that, I wasn't ready for. I didn't really... I mean, I took the tape from the practice space to... New York, and I shopped it myself. I think I had 6 or 7 meetings. And I walk into Geffen, and I walk into Arista, and I walk with a cassette tape, and I play it, and we listen to it. And they go, oh, well, so you want to make this kind of record? And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, these are my new songs. And, yeah, people, I should have put that song first, but it didn't even occur to me, you know? So by the time we finished recording it for real, the guy that became our manager, he got about halfway through it and stopped it and said, I want to manage this band.
Wow.
So people could hear something there that I was clearly unaware of. Huh. And I guess they, they heard some potential there that they, I guess, were right about.
Yeah, I'd say. Absolutely. Man, it's such a killer record for me. I mean, for me, that there was just there. I was so into music, and when that came out, I mean, I just ate up every song on there. Was it for being such a personal song? Was it strange to be like out there so much to feel like you're being that vulnerable and have so many people come back and say that they identify with it? Was that strange or like rewarding or what was that like?
Strange, yes. Rewarding.
Or maybe not rewarding. Like, did people say, oh, I felt that too, and your song helped me? Was it ever that kind of thing?
That kind of thing.
Okay.
Like, it was actually kind of a reaffirmation that I'm not
alone.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Alone, whatever. Yeah. I mean, I just think I was being about as personal as I'd ever care to be, and it sort of struck a nerve with a lot of people. And yeah, it made me feel, not as crazy as I thought. I was going absolutely nuts when I wrote that song. I really was in a strange place. So, yeah.
Interesting. Do you remember any songs that you were kind of thinking through? Like, I could see a Springsteen song almost being like an inspiration. Maybe, I don't know, but was there any other song you were like, yeah, I'd kind of like to do a, this type of song, or not really?
No, actually. Okay. That's interesting. I think at that point I had sort of thrown everything out the window. I was just like, I don't know what to do. I'm not really focused on playing a million miles an hour as loud as I can anymore. And I think it was pretty much informed by the same writers that I've always sort of looked to in a way. I mean, Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and people like that. But there wasn't a sound or anything. There wasn't there wasn't really an aesthetic that I was looking for. I was just being open-minded about not having to make a really hard punk rock record. And that was just it was just sort of a natural thing as far as not beating myself over the head with the same formula or whatever.
Sure.
I was just kind of, messing around and feeling lost and trying anything, but also trying to jam Eco by doing it on acoustic guitar.
Well, what was that? I mean, you kind of mentioned it there, but like, the 80s, you guys had so much harder material, and then the 90s hit, which was really a lot of grunge music, which that's the point when you went the opposite way, where you like kind of said, where you kind of embraced the acoustic guitar, at least a little bit on that song. And I think of y'all, your 90s albums as more, not singer songwriter, but certainly not the grunge rock sound. Was that intentional, or was that just for survival out of the band of like you're saying, I can't keep doing this heavy rock. I need to hear something else.
Well, I think that like the last song on Grave Dancers Union was for me a real punk rock statement. It just, it flew in the face of everything that was kind of the aesthetic. And it's funny, the thing that came to my mind was when Black Flag started playing everything really slow. Because it is just sort of, it was react the opposite and do the opposite. And so that's kind of what was going on. I was just like, well, what if punk rock is anti everything, what's anti punk rock?
And
I guess that was, you know, my weird sensibility.
And it worked. I'm a huge Nirvana fan as well, and I know they were big around when this album came out in the Grave Dancers Union. When I know that there was the quote that I always read that when Courtney Love met Kurt Cobain, she said, "You look like Dave Perner," which I'm sure you've heard that a million times. What were you around him or around them in those circles at all?
Well, we spent a lot of time in Washington State. You know, we spent a lot of time playing in Portland and Seattle and God, you know. So I think inadvertently we were part of something that was growing in a way that we didn't really understand how it was catching on, because we had been doing it for so long. So, you know, when I think back on those early days in Tacoma, Washington, and you know, playing at these sort of crazy house parties and stuff, my guess is that a lot of the people that ended up in a lot of the bands from that area were around. I mean, it was, you know, I remember opening for Husker Du at a place called, God, I don't remember the name of the place, but a lot of, that's when I kind of realized, oh God, there's something happening in Seattle. And I think that there was a lot of people that ended up being in established, I don't know, bands that a lot of people have heard of.
Yeah.
At that show.
Yeah. Well, did I see recently that you guys are putting out a cassette version of the new record? Is that right?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit? I thought that was cool.
Well, I think it just came out. I got a call and I was like, "Hey, the record company wants to put out cassettes." And I was like,
"Really?
Kidding." I just couldn't. And you know, I don't even know when the last time one of our records came out on cassette was. I mean,
yeah.
So I don't know if it's kind of, you know, a novelty or what. I mean, I heard something interesting about kids buying cassettes at Salvation Army for a quarter, and they didn't really care like what was on them. They just liked the meat. Anyways, there's only 500 of them, so nice. Get them while they're hot.
Nice. All right. I love it. I thought that was a cool throwback. And so for people who are going to check out the new record, the Hurry Up and Wait, is there one song you'd point out and say, hey, be sure and don't miss this? Would it, If I Told You is one that I really love, got it pretty good. I don't know if there's one that comes to mind that you think people should for sure listen to.
Well, I mean, every song on the record is a classic. I'm kidding.
It's good. I've really enjoyed it. I've been listening to it a ton. I think it's so good.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, we're definitely going in a different direction now. And, you know, I thought the song Make Her Laugh was kind of overlooked in a weird way. But, you know, whatever. I don't know, because now I'm pretty far into this new record I'm working on.
Nice, you're in that headspace.
You know, it's not it's not like the last one, and that's kind of, I think part of the thing is to, like I was saying before, just to not repeat myself.
Right.
So yeah, this will take us in a direction that, you know, hopefully would be really interesting. I mean, I'm kind of writing some real angular kind of music where there's time changes and time signature changes, and it's just kind of, I don't know, it's challenging music, and I'm trying to sort of at least get into that for now.
Cool.
Which is kind of, you know, I'm not sure if it's gonna, how well a lot of this stuff is gonna work in a live situation, but it could be great. I mean, I just don't know. So you kind of write a song, and then you play it with the band, and it either really gels or it leaves people going, well, I don't really understand what I'm supposed to do. So, yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to playing this music live.
Nice. Because
right now it's all just, it's demos of me playing most of the instruments.
Okay.
And that's kind of how I do things during a pandemic.
Well, you're being productive. That's a positive. I mean, I'm impressed that you're already writing in those kind of songs and doing all that. I think a lot of people, it's been easy to shut down. So you felt productive during this time?
At first, not at all. Yeah. I mean, at first people were like, oh, is this a creative time for you? And I was like, no.
Mm.
My tour got cut short, and I don't understand what's happening, and I don't feel inspired, for lack of a better word. And then, I don't know, I just sort of went, all right, let's make a record. And then it just sort of kicked in. But for a while there, it was very, it was difficult for me to see outside the house, you know?
Yeah.
I just couldn't. Like, I couldn't understand what was happening.
Yeah.
It wasn't inspiring. It just felt like, what the fuck is going on?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I got over it. You know, now we're starting to talk about actually going and playing a show somewhere.
Yeah. And I imagine that feels great.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be a real relief as far as feeling pent up and out of shape.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
I mean, I'm sure it's true for so many people of just, you know, feeling so cooped up and not yourself and not normal during this whole time. At least for me, it feels like there's a hope on the horizon of, okay, I think things are starting to turn, and so I hope that they do. And I'm sure people are going to be pumped to come out to shows again and get back to normal. So, man, Dave, I just appreciate you being willing to come on and talk about the Hurry Up and Wait record, the new record you're working on, and indulging me with some old song questions. And I love your band, I love your songwriting, and I just wish you the very best. Thanks so much for coming on the show to talk today.
Thank you, Ryan. Have yourself a great afternoon.
All right, you too. Thanks, Dave.
All right, take it easy, man.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.